Hello everyone, this is Ryan Dawson of ANC Report, that's the Anti-Neocon Report, giving you the podcast today. I've got Pepe Escobar coming on, followed by David Cole / David Stein. And I don't have commercials in these podcasts, but I would like to encourage everybody to click on the donate button either below or up, depending on what page you are listening to this on, and consider donating a couple bucks. For you, it's just $2 or $3. For me, it could be tens of thousands of dollars because there's thousands of listeners. And you guys make this viable. There are those who donate already. But if we could just have a single money bomb, if you guys think it's worth it, you want to hear Pepe, you want to hear David Stein, you want to hear the guest afterward, consider the impact we can have. In one day, you could generate thousands of dollars. I'd create a studio. I'd hire people. The production value of all of this would go through the roof. And it would only cost you $3 or $4, which I think all these podcasts and the articles, it's a free service. It's worth it. I think it's worth it. I've been putting free stuff out there for 13 years, and I could really use your support. So please consider that. Hit the donate button below. Sorry for ranting. It's a win-win for everybody. And if you can spare it, there is a way to set up a monthly donation so that you give $5 a month, $3 a month, but you can cancel at any time, too. Which is good for me because I can anticipate about how much is coming in and spend accordingly. We can really make this take off. It's already grown a lot this year. Please continue supporting my work and I will continue to research to the best of my abilities and get the best guests I can for interviews, all for you guys, as well as making movies, books, etc. This is how we do it. Stick it to the man together. Thank you very much. Now enjoy Pepe Escobar talking about pipelines in Ukraine and geopolitics.
Okay, excellent. Pepe Escobar from Age of Times is back once again. I love talking to Pepe Escobar because I get great analysis and somehow he's able to take the darkest subjects and make them jovial and fun and interesting. Welcome back to the show, Pepe.
My pleasure, Ryan. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Now, you've written this piece over on Asia Times, and it was on Information Clearinghouse, and it's gone around everywhere, called Ukraine, the Grand Chessboard. And it talks about pipelines and Iran, Russia, China, the U.S., Europe, minor stuff like that. But I thought we'd dig into it.
Starting off with John Brennan of the CIA, the director, and Jennifer Patsky of the State Department, these little neocons' lies about Kiev and Ukraine have completely fallen apart. The narrative they were trying to weave is just a farce. It's at comical levels now. I'm waiting for somebody to say they were trying to buy Yellow Creek from Niger at this point. So with that unraveling, what do you see happening now? What will happen to Ukraine's assets? How are they going to pay the debt? Are sanctions going to be laid on Russia? Will they have a response? Will Gazprom have a response to that to the Europeans? How do you see this shaking out over the next month?
Look, basically, the Russian strategy, I think they delineated their strategy already by January, early February, even before the coup, the Russians. They knew from the beginning that Ukraine was payback organized in this particular case, by the State Department. For the multiple defeats of American foreign policy, Syria, Egypt, Snowden, you name it. So they identify the payback. Okay, let's try to fuck up Ukraine, basically. And they did. They already have the $5 billion that Vicky Nuland confessed live to the whole world. They had the NGOs in place. They could pay the usual suspects.
Point out that that was back in December when that money was seeded. Yes.
Yeah. So, and the Russian response, it's a very long-term thing, the way I see it. I was in Moscow last week. I had some very interesting conversations over there and more or less confirmed what I suspected before. Putin, basically, he wants to retune the whole international system, which is it's not even a tall order. It's maybe the tallest order ever, right? Change the system of the hyperpower, the hegemon, the American century, you name it, upside down. and replace it with the emerging multipolar world. He has allies, of course, the BRICS countries, some countries inside the G20, many of the countries of the 120-plus non-allied movement, NAM, most of the developing world, I would say. But the reaction is going to be really, really hardcore. And we can see that already in Ukraine. Everybody knew on both sides, the American side and the Russian side, that Ukraine was, is, and will continue to be a completely divided country, roughly 50-50. The western part is linked to Lithuania, linked to Poland. Don't forget that Poland and Lithuania, centuries ago, they dominated parts of what is today known as Ukraine. And the eastern part is Russia. And that would include Kiev, because Kiev for the Russians is something very emotional. It's part of the heart of the motherland, in fact. And all the eastern part, for all the obvious reasons that we know, the industry is closely linked with Russian industry. Most of them are Russophones. They were educated in Russian. Their values are Russian. Their culture is Russian. They are Russian Orthodox, for that matter. Most of the Western Ukraine is Christian. So it's a country completely divided. The only possible solution, if we had a non-Hobbesian world, as I put it, would be a neutral, a Finlandized Ukraine. And it's fascinating to see that even certified American Cold Warriors of the Henry Kissinger brand, they agree that the only possible solution for Ukraine is Finlandization, a neutral Ukraine. But the Americans upped the ante. They said, no, we need our payback as soon as possible. They got it. The problem is they, as usual, or, you know, if you go back on the record all the time, in fact, they didn't have a follow-up plan. It's not even a plan B, a follow-up plan. Okay, what do we do with the oligarchs and neo-fascists and whatever's that we're going to put in place in Kiev? These people, they cannot even control Western Ukraine properly, not to mention the machinery of government in Kiev. And in Eastern Ukraine, they launched what they call an anti-terrorist operation, which, by the way, was recommended by Brennan when he visited Kiev 2 or 3 days before the beginning of said operation. So, you know, the link is absolutely immediate. You have the director of the CIA going over there and telling those that bunch of neo-fascist, Yarush, private sector, you name it. Okay, you go over there and you smash those people in the east who are occupying buildings in the east. The fact obviously escaped them that in Maidan, they were also occupying buildings in Maidan, and they had snipers shooting on all sides. But okay, let's forget about that. Let's consider that we have an anti-terrorist operation that is supposed to clear the decks in eastern Ukraine in a few days. As we know by now, this turned into a bloody farce. And the government in Kiev, they have no plan B. And Russia, they always had, in fact, a plan A, B, and C, which is we sit tight. We don't do anything. We have our exercises in the Russian-Ukrainian border. We can deploy as many as 25,000, then come back. This is absolutely normal. It's just exercises. We don't do anything. We support the people in eastern Ukraine, let's say diplomatically, politically, maybe financially, but we don't intervene via military means. But if this thing gets really out of hand, which is if Russian speakers or Russophones start getting killed, probably en masse by Kiev forces, then Russia will be forced to intervene. And Putin made this very clear in his 4-hour Q&A session, which obviously was not reported as it should have been in America. He said many, many important things. He more or less outlined his policies on Ukraine. He more or less outlined that, yes, he wants to change the rules of the international game. This is it was practically explicit, in fact. If you go through the 4-hour answers, you know, from all sorts. It was really good. Can you imagine an American president, a French president, or an English prime minister going live for 4 hours, answering questions from everybody with no teleprompter? Never. You know,
no teleprompter. Obama would lose his mind.
He would lose his. Hollande wouldn't last 30 seconds. David Cameron, you know, because, you know, his rhetorical skills, maybe he will last 15 minutes. And but he'll be lost in the beginning, from the start.
Harper, it's about 5 seconds.
Exactly. So, you know, so most of it is there. What is behind the scenes is also very interesting, which is... I would say a very, very strong debate among people who advise Putin that he trusts. And roughly, it's two camps. One camp we call the Eurasian sovereignists, which they bet basically on sovereign developing countries, rule of law in international relations, and a new Eurasian-wide trade commerce link, which would include all countries in the Eurasian landmass, and including Eastern Europe and Europe itself. And on the other camp, we have what they sometimes call liberal internationalists, but in fact, these are neoliberal internationalists. And one of my interlocutors in Moscow, he was trying to tell me, look, this there are no liberal internationalists here. All of them are neoliberal. They want a neoliberal Russia, part of the American-led system. And that's why they are in frontal clash with the Kremlin, because the Kremlin wants this whole thing to go upside down. So there is a debate inside the Russian leadership involving business leaders, involving some very, very powerful oligarchs as well. So this is very interesting. But the basic Kremlin policy from now on is, look, we're not going to sit tight and let the Americans get away with anything. We fight back. And that's why I would say Washington now is more or less paralyzed. They don't know how to deal with Russia because it's fantastic. If you scour the mainstream media and also the think tanks and, you know, the peer papers, you name it, everybody is puzzled. Everybody's trying to decipher Putin's mind. You know, in fact, 5 minutes ago, the lead story in Foreign Policy, I just got the email with what goes on in Putin's mind or some crap like that. You know, it's ridiculous. It's very simple. Why don't you go to Moscow, stay there 3 days, talk to some people? You're going to see what's going on. Yeah. You won't see it from Washington, from the Beltway. Definitely not, you know. Anyway, so now this is more or less clear. And the Russian strategy is defensive, apparently inactive and passive. But if they see an opening, they will keep pouncing. It's very, very interesting because it's very different from what it was until last year, let's put it this way, with the Syrian crisis. You remember, with the Syrian crisis, if the Russians did nothing, the Obama administration would start another war in the Middle East for all practical purposes. They start bombing Damascus as they were threatening. And the Pentagon was saying, we don't do light stuff. So it would be another mini shock and awe, 150 missiles, and God knows what will happen afterwards. And they were saved at the last minute by the Russian proposition and by Lavrov convincing Kerry and then Kerry convincing Obama, look, we have a way out. Which is the Russian plan in the end of
well, it was important because they had a face saving way out where they said, well, the Russians are going to help us go in and make sure we get rid of these chemical weapons, even though the narrative on that of Assad gassing people was very suspect because the prior two times they had said that exact same myth, it had been the terrorist groups who did it,
and not the government. Russian intelligence at the time, they already knew that it was a false flag. They took those all the information that they had to the UN Security Council. Ambassador Churkin, in fact, he briefed members of the Security Council. A lot of people were not convinced, but some of them were, in fact. The BRICS, they had a common position that, no, this is completely absurd. And Germany was saying, no, let's try to talk. It's impossible. Like, a bombing Syria is not. So it, already at the time.
Yeah, but John Kerry was saying no, too, but with a K. He was 35 times he said, we know they have these chemical weapons and they use them. And they didn't know. They didn't have any evidence.
No, they did. Of course they didn't. Of course they didn't, because it was Russian intelligence who found that out. And and there were some people on the net who were doing some very, very good investigations, comparing everything, you know, tonnage, where these mortars were launched from, trajectories, you name it. And they came to the same conclusions. It was probably a false flag. Not to mention that famous interview at the time. You remember when they interviewed people in Ghouta, and they said, look, there were some suspicious Arabs here a while ago, and then they disappeared and all that. So this was probably one of Bandar Bush's cells, in fact, that conducted the whole. By the way, bye-bye Bandar, né? as we talked about it a few months ago.
Yeah, he's slipping.
He's long.
He fell.
He is now in one of his villas in the south of France. Oh, wow. He's living well, but he's out of the picture. So to finish our what we're talking about. So unlike what they did last year, which was to save the Obama administration, now the Kremlin, now it's a frontal clash. And let's see what the Americans are going to do. So they put the bomb on the Americans' court, in fact. You're going to have more sanctions against us, or we're going to retaliate. Sanctions against Gazprom, if they happen. Well, we have the Asian markets for us, which is the crux of the matter in the next few years.
What I don't understand about that is the Russian counterpunch is going to be hit them a lot harder than sanctions that can be placed on Russia.
Yeah.
As you wrote, they can turn off the spigot, you know. The other thing I want to address before we get into that is with, you know, just because this is easy to dismiss, we have Anders from the NATO Secretary General saying they want to expand NATO. I don't see that as likely to happen. What do you think?
No, but
I mean, I think it's impossible.
fog of war. Fog is a joke. Even in Brussels, they consider him a joke. Of course.
Rasmussen, yeah.
After the bottle of Bordeaux, you should see what those diplomats in Brussels, what they talk about fog, you know. Anyway.
No, the diplomats in Brussels argue for 40 minutes about what color folders they have.
Color-coded folders. Oh, yeah, that's
remember,
what...
Remember that?
When I first became acquainted with the folders in the mid-90s, I said, oh, man, I have something that I'll be talking about this till I die.
That's just the government bureaucracy at its finest.
No, it's color-coded Kafka, in fact. 1,000 people with color-coded folders. In 25 different languages. No wonder they cannot agree on anything. Just as an aside, you know their energy policy? They have been discussing a common European energy policy, as far as I remember, since 2003, 2004. And they still don't have one. Can you believe it? The only thing that they can do, the Russians, it's very hard to negotiate with the Russians, blah, 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 chess masters, they're tough, blah, 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 blah. Of course, they cannot even find an accord among themselves in Europe. So, and now the new Secretary General of NATO is going to be a Norwegian, which is a very interesting point. Do you know that NATO was founded under the suggestion of a Norwegian diplomat in the first place? So now we have the next Secretary General, a Norwegian as well, which they pose as pacifists, but not really. Just like the Swedes. The Swedes are more upfront about it, but there's nothing pacifist about Norwegians as well. Anyway, where were we? We were on pipelines, right? Yeah,
cutting off. I was talking about the counterpunch. If they put sanctions on Gazprom, you've got Ukraine completely in debt, and Gazprom, besides the Nord Stream line that goes to Germany, all those lines go through Ukraine. And if they cut off the oil, that means the European countries west of the Ukraine aren't going to get it either.
Exactly. So first of all, they cannot impose sanctions on Gazprom because it's so interconnected. And in most of these pipelines, there are European companies involved, Dutch companies, Italian companies, French companies. So the symbiosis among the oil and gas giants in the West, and that includes Russia, it's huge. So they would be sanctioning themselves, of course. If they would slap some sort of sanctions related to Gazprom, let's say parallel sanctions, underground sanctions, Russia could retaliate in a very simple manner. They stop the shipment of gas to Ukraine. Of course, everything that goes through Ukraine, most of it keeps going on to Europe. If they shut off the spigot going to Ukraine, obviously Ukraine would have to compensate by getting some of the gas that would be destined to European countries for itself. Especially winter is approaching. It's soon.
Happened before. Was it 2005 or so, where they actually, because of debt and Ukraine routinely not paying the bills, they turned off the gas.
So can you imagine the Italians one day they wake up and say, where is our gas? Ah, it's in Ukraine. It didn't arrive this morning. you see the possibilities, right? Yeah. So this is totally impossible. What they are threatening is sanctions on individuals linked to the Kremlin. Well, the Kremlin can do the same thing about, let's say, heads of American multinationals who have businesses in Russia, for instance. They are not going to like that one bit. So the sanctions threat war, it's a miss. It's not going to solve anything. The problem is the Obama administration doesn't have a political plan for the Ukraine. They are betting on these elections where we have two pro-American candidates. The chocolate billionaire and Saint Yulia Tymoshenko.
The former prime minister.
The former prime minister, extremely corrupt. And by the way, she did deals with the previous pro-Russian regimes in Russia as well. She's not pro-American. She's pro-business and especially pro-business for her own pockets. Average Ukrainians, they know about that. So the chocolate billionaire, he stands a good another oligarch, he stands a good chance of winning.
Poroshenko.
Poroshenko, exactly.
I like chocolate billionaire better, but I'm just for everyone else.
Of course. Yeah. Okay, so we have Poroshenko as the next president, let's put it this way, surrounded by a bunch of oligarchs. Some of them are already part of the picture because they were appointed by this caretaker government to take care of many important provinces, including provinces in the east, Dnipro, Donetsk, you know, everywhere. How are they going to solve this total split in the country unless there is a constitutional reform and unless there are steps toward federalization? This government already, okay, for their credit, I'm giving them some credit for the moment. They say, look, there's going to be a lot of consultations from now on until October. So maybe around October, November, we're going to have some amendments to the constitution, including more autonomy to especially eastern provinces. But let's see what's going to be in it in terms of Russian being recognized as an official language as well, in terms of they taking care, you know, they collecting their own taxes, and not diverting a lot of cash to Kiev. We still don't know the terms. They're saying that there are going to be some reforms. We don't know. And the problem still remains. This deal, the so-called deal between Kerry, Lavrov, and Catherine Ashton last week in Geneva, nobody's respecting the deal anymore. Starting with, I love the way they call themselves, People's Republic of Donetsk. This is beautiful. That reminds me of my my good old days of a People's Republic in the 60s and 70s, you know, when we all dreamed of People's Republic everywhere, you know, even, I don't know, Golden Gate Park, Hanoi, Argentina, you know. Anyway, they said that they're not leaving. So what are the Russians going to do? Are they going to weaponize these people? No. Are they going to still support them? Yes. But for how long? And sooner or later, things will come to a head. So how are you going to displace them? What are you going to offer them? Look, wait until the elections in May 25 and then we talk. They're not going to wait for another month over there. They're still going to occupy those buildings. You know, they're not going to dissolve tomorrow. So this is complicated because Russia has to manage a short-term explosive situation and a very long-term, even more explosive situation, which is to basically, from now on, confront everything that the Americans are doing and will keep doing.
And how is the Ukraine going to pay its debts, its $15 billion or 15 billion euro debts? I know the IMF and Japan and some others have been loaning them money, but that's just passing the responsibility to a new party because now they owe them the money. They don't have any capital to pay it with.
Nothing. Absolutely.
And they lost Crimea, which they used to offset a portion of that by, you know, allowing them to use their waters and have the base. They would say, okay, well, a portion of your debt has been paid for that allowance. They lost that too, so they're going further and further in the hole. Absolutely. The IMF has another client state, but it just seemed like the next banana republic.
It is. It is already a banana republic. Once again, without the bananas, just like Egypt, you know, a banana republic with a lot of grain, which in terms of American agribusiness, it's interesting. They could always go to Western Ukraine and take care of all that grain.
Monsanto was buying grain elevators and ports prior to the coup d'etat.
Yeah. And of course, it's going to be run by the IMF. It already is, because they already promised the first tranche. $15 billion is not even enough to pay all their debt in the short and medium term is almost $30 billion. $15 billion is okay, only half of it, and they have to pay it back. So the country now is basically a slave of the IMF. Slave of the IMF means slave of Washington, slave of a few European countries who have a majority votes in the IMF. Of course, like Brazil, India, and China are also part of it. But most of that money is not going to come from the BRICS allotments inside the IMF. It's going to come from the Americans and the Europeans. Mm-hmm. And the European Union itself, they are broke to bail out Ukraine per se. Second, there's absolutely no strategic value as, but there's no political value or even human value for the EU to absorb Ukraine. Even if Ukraine would apply for EU membership, it would take another 10 years for it. And I could bet that 90% of the EU members would say no. If there were referendums in the individual EU countries about admission of Ukraine, nobody wants it.
I think Ukraine would say no too.
Exactly. And when you look at the latest numbers that we have in the polls, most Ukrainians don't want it as well. So what do they want, in fact, considering that it's a 50-50 split country? I would say that most of them, in fact, would like a neutral Ukraine. It would be fantastic. It's not going to happen. Everybody knows. If we had a referendum within the next 2 or 3 months, we'd think, okay, how do you see the future of Ukraine? Most people would vote, okay, we good commercial relations with both the European Union and Russia. That's it. And most of them would say no NATO bases.
Which was the initial offer that the IMF would not accept. They're like, no, us or them, and they wouldn't allow them to go both ways.
And we always forget a key part of the refusal by Yanukovych. Hear me?
Yeah, I got, you know, it's Bangkok sometimes.
Oh, it's Bangkok is a piece of shit, man. Tell me. I know, it's a fuck.
You're talking about, yeah, I know how it is. You're talking about the key puzzle that Yanukovych that's not talked about, because I was explaining how the initial deal was that they didn't have to pick just one or the other, and the IMF wasn't having it. And you were expanding on that before the line got dropped.
Exactly. So the key point is that the renegotiation that Yanukovych wanted about the association agreement with the EU concerned two key points. Number one, Ukraine would not follow NATO military protocol because Yanukovych said, no, I don't want NATO military bases here now or in the near future. And number two is the terms were pro-EU too much in his view. And big European agricultural groups, they could, you know, take over most of the Ukrainian agriculture, not to mention Ukrainian industry, and flood Ukraine with European products, and Ukrainian industry would basically collapse. So these were the two main sticking points, you know, and they were still talking when Maidan happened, in fact. He said, no, I'm not, I did not say that this is over. No, we need to renegotiate the terms. And then in the middle of this renegotiation, the Maidan ball started rolling with all the results that we know. And it was very fast in the end. And of course, there was a mix of players. Not only the there was a legitimate movement that we want was an anti-corruption movement, not only particular against Yanukovych, but against all oligarchs. And the irony is that some of these oligarchs are back, or they joined power because of the new government in Kiev, and some of them are governing eastern provinces nowadays. So it's still a corrupt government, now with American support, run with the neo-fascists in security positions and with oligarchs all over the place. So it hasn't changed much. Okay, it's much worse now because now it's a slave of the IMF to boot. So, oh my God, they are in a shithole.
How does the U.S. justify its positions supporting all these racists? You have the neo-Nazis in Ukraine, you've got the Zionists in Israel, and you've got these Islamic fanatics in Syria, all of them who can't stand anybody but their own group, but yeah, getting aid from the U.S. and total support for terrorists.
Exactly. No, they ignore it. if you follow the think tanks, if you read mainstream media, if you watch the major networks in the U.S., they simply ignore it, of course. It's still the same thing, the good terrorists and the bad terrorists, the good Taliban and the bad Taliban. And remember last year, when we saw the rise of the good Al-Qaeda and the bad Al-Qaeda.
Well, they had that magic line, line in Syria and Iraq, you know.
Absolutely. So the good Al-Qaeda is when they fight for us in Syria. The bad Al-Qaeda is when they fight against us in Iraq. And so forth, you know. And it applies to the whole world. Same thing, in, I remember, same thing in Latin America in the 70s. It was the same thing. And then later on in Latin America, okay, if you have a leftist government that works with us, they're good. If you have a leftist government that antagonizes, like in Venezuela or sometimes Bolivia, they're evil. It's primary, it's parochial, it's provincial, it's obtuse, it's either or. But we already know that this is how foreign policy works in the U.S. It's everybody in the developing world, they have no illusions about it anymore. By the way, it's fantastic. I was doing some retrospective work here. And do you remember the defense planning guides and in the 90s?
Oh,
the
early 90s?
You probably remember that. Yeah, so I stumbled into the draft version of the 1992 defense planning guide. And it's absolutely fascinating. I'm going to use it in one of my next articles. It's verbatim what Brzezinski says in the Grand Chessboard, which he published in 1997. In fact, fascinating. So Brzezinski got it from the defense planning guide or vice versa. But it proves to you that Democrat or Republican, it doesn't matter. It's only one. It's one thought only. In fact, we need to prevent the emergence of a regional or a local regional competitor in Southwest Asia, across Eurasia, or in East Asia.
Yep. So any economic or military rival to break up U.S. hegemony. And the planning guidance was really the precursor to PNAC and the Project for New American Century and the ISBS papers and Clean Break and everything was all defense planning guidance.
So it hasn't changed anything. So, and this was written 1 year after the fall of the Soviet Union. And the fall of the Soviet Union was December 1991.
Lord, please don't drop the call. It was getting so good.
I'm still here?
Oh, yeah, you're back. Yeah. December 1991, I think you're going to say, but...
1 year after the fall of the Soviet Union, Defense Planning Guide said, no, we're going to be, it's going to be Pax Americana forever. They were already thinking about the 21st century as an American century. So everything that we heard afterwards coming from Hillary, from Biden, from Obama, was already there in 1992. And it was conceptualized later on by Brzezinski in 1997. So it's still the same. It's exactly the same thing. And obviously the Russians. At the time, they had their horribilis. It was not annus horribilis, it was a decade horribilis, it was their 90s. And then with Putin, they started to have another decade to, okay, let's get rid of everything that went wrong in the 90s. Let's try to re-stabilize this country. And then we start to have the role that we used to have before in international relations. And now that's it. And we're still going to have another, okay, Putin's going to be in power for until the end of this decade. So it's now it's a match. Now it's the real thing. Whatever administration, the end of the Obama administration and the next U.S. administration, be it Hillary or anybody else, now you have a real competitor because now the clash now is frontal. And Russia and China at the same time are getting closer and closer. So I would say that until the end of this decade, we're going to have some fireworks all over the spectrum. That's for sure. Starting next month with Putin visiting Xi Jinping in Beijing, when I would say it's 90% clear that they're going to finally sign the famous 30-year gas deal, Siberian gas to China, with very good prices. And the key question, how this is going to be paid? Will it be paid in rubles, in yuan, in a basket of currencies bypassing the dollar? Because this is going to be really thermonuclear. Because other developing world countries are going to follow this as well. Brazil is going to do the same thing with its energy sales. Venezuela is going to do the same thing. Iran is already doing it for a while. So you can imagine the repercussions of all this.
Yeah, so, and Alexei Miller, Gazprom CEO, was in China already this week.
Yes. So
kind of setting the groundwork for that, I'm sure, for the coup de grace. And also next month, we have the possibility, well, supposedly, it's the end of the 6 months of the interim plan for Iran to possibly lift sanctions or not. And I wanted to ask you about that because if Russia shuts off the gas, or they know they can anyway, where is Europe going to get its gas? It can either get it from Iran if sanctions are lifted, or it's going to be forced to buy the shale gas from the United States.
The shale gas thing is everybody. If you talk to any energy expert, you'll say, "Look, it will take at least 10 years for the U.S. to start exporting shale gas to the rest of the world. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen tomorrow. This year, 2015. Forget it. So there is no plan B involving U.S. shale gas in the medium and even long term." The best, I would say, immediate term solution would be Iran. Then we need, for this we need, number one, a deal struck, let's say, in the second semester of 2014. It's in the interest of the Europeans now to have a deal with Iran, because then the next day we have the progressive lifting of sanctions. We have something that the Europeans have been complaining all the time. Damn, we depend on Gazprom because we cannot make deals with Iran or with anybody else in the Middle East because of transportation systems. So the next day we're going to have BP, Total, Eni from Italy, everybody disembarking in Tehran. Okay, let's do deals. We want to invest in your oil and gas industry, upgrade your facilities. We want to buy more oil and gas from you. for the Europeans, this is the real thing. The problem is the people who some of the people who run energy policy in European countries, they know it. The politicians, if you get David Cameron, Hollande, these are absolute idiots. In fact, they are ideological. That's a problem. So they are ideologically opposed to the Iranian regime. So they are prepared to shoot themselves or their countries on feet all the time. But that will be the only possible solution for Europe, because Nabucco is not going to happen, which would be the competitor to the South Stream pipeline. Mm-hmm. Cannot get extra gas from Turkmenistan, because Turkmenistan is selling all its excess gas production to, guess who? China. Obviously, the Chinese built the pipeline from Turkmenistan to Western China via Uzbekistan in late 2009, in fact. Mm-hmm. Late 2009, absolutely. So Qatar is impossible. We come back to the Syria war. You remember the famous deal struck by Iran, Iraq, and Syria.
$10 billion
pipeline going to Syria, Eastern Mediterranean, and then from the Eastern Mediterranean to European clients. The alternative route would be from Qatar and going through Syria, of course, Jordan, and then Eastern Mediterranean. But that would imply a friendly government in Syria, which would mean a Muslim Brotherhood-dominated government in Syria, which was what Qatar wanted from day one. This has collapsed completely. First of all, because Qatar is not running the armed groups in Syria anymore. Saudi Arabia eliminated Qatar from the Syria picture completely. Saudi Arabia is in an internal mess of its own because of the succession, because of the strategy of Bandar Bush was an absolute failure as well, and he had to be replaced. So the House of Saud is an absolute mess. They don't even know what they're doing in Syria anymore.
You called that, by the way. You called that whole thing with Bandar. Just pointing that out for people.
Absolutely.
And you can see that conflict in Syria, too. They want perpetual – you're talking about defense plan and guidance earlier. To go back to other old policy papers, Oded Yanan from Israel, they keep the struggle even. Every time the government has almost wiped them out, Israel goes in and does some airstrikes and it sends more support, or the Turks or somebody, to keep that – the result they want is no result. They just want perpetual conflict for as long as they can drag it out, and that's exactly what they wrote about in the 80s.
Absolutely. It's the empire of chaos. It's still the best definition that applies. This definition, by the way, was coined by a French political scientist, unfortunately not translated in the West. He wrote an absolutely outstanding book published, if I remember well, in 2002 in France, before the Iraq War. And the title was L'Empire du Chaos, The Empire of Chaos. And if you read the book today, it's like he wrote the book last week, in fact. Everything applies. And it is the empire of chaos. You create chaos all over. You do divide and rule in every possible latitude. So you have local players fighting each other. For example, this bogus Sunni-Shiite war, which is not totally an American invention. It was a Jordanian-Saudi Arabian invention, but then the Americans jumped on it because they said, this is perfect. It's the perfect dividing rule for us to keep everybody fighting each other in Southwest Asia as a whole. The Ukraine strategy, let's put it this way. Perfect. We get a divided Ukraine on Russian borders. It's even better. It's like a sort of Afghanistan remix without the Mujahideen, in fact, on Russia's borders. And we're going to entice them to invade, just like we enticed them to invade Afghanistan in 1979. It's always the same modus operandi. Always. Absolutely. Always the same. So this doesn't fool anybody anymore, at least informed observers all across the developing world, and especially in the BRICS countries, you know. So what's the alternative? So the BRICS are investing in their development bank. They are accelerating trade and commerce in their own currencies. If this deal, the Siberian gas to China, is clinched and it's the pricing and the payment system involves a basket of currencies as well. It's another game changer. So incrementally, little by little, they're trying to change the rules of the game on the economic front. Politically, they know they cannot go frontally against the U.S. The Chinese position, for instance, at the moment is very, very complicated because they are part of the international system as it is. They know that the U.S. is trying to sort of seduce them and bribe them to be sort of the number two in the international pecking order. Look, we keep the Pax Americana, but you are the number two very responsible player in international relations. The Chinese don't want that. The Chinese want to make their own rules, and they know that until what? 2018. In the next 4 years, they're going to be the number one economic power in the world. Everybody agrees with that. It could be 2017, 2018, 2020, but it's inevitable. When they get to this position, they will want to dictate the rules of the game, period. Just look at Imperial Chinese history. Nowadays, it's not an empire anymore. It's not expansionist, but they will be back to the position that they were for, you know, 18 of the past 20th centuries. Number one economic power in the world. And of course, it's going to be their rules. So they need another international system. The Russians also want another international system. Brazil and India, same thing. So now it is, I would say, a long-term, not so frontal, but decisive clash between the BRICS on one side and the U.S. and some Europeans on the other. Other Europeans, they're, you know, basically preoccupied with their own internal problems, in fact, would be what? France, Germany, and England allied with the U.S. against the BRICS. And the Germans, they know that the best way for them is to clinch deals as well. They already have a very close trade partnership with Russia. Mm-hmm. When Xi Jinping went to Germany last month, he was talking openly about a new Silk Road. The Silk Road, there are 1,000 Silk Roads blooming at the moment, no? Mao style, in fact. So he was telling German media, now we're going to build a Silk Road from Xinjiang to Dortmund and Dusseldorf. And the Germans obviously love it. But the problem is, if this goes overland, Ukraine is in the middle of the Silk Road. So obviously, the Americans don't want an European-Asian integrated Silk Road at all. They would like to control the Silk Road. Remember when Hillary Clinton herself launched an American Silk Road, which was a joke. It didn't go anywhere. This was like 3 years ago or so when she was still a Secretary of State. So we have the Chinese are doing a Silk Road through Central Asia. They are investing in a Silk Road through Southeast Asia. They are investing now in a Silk Road that goes all across Eurasia and all the way to Europe, crossing Eastern Europe and getting to Germany as well. So this spells out more integration between Asia and Europe. The Americans don't want that. It's still the same thing. We want to control Eurasia. It's still defense planning guide. It's still Brzezinski. It's the same shit. And the Russians, of course, they are getting closer with the Chinese with this energy partnership and also a political partnership. The problem for the Chinese in all this interlocking relationship is that they cannot fully antagonize the Americans now. They have to buy their time. When they become the number one economic power, when they expand their navy, when they have enough anti-aircraft subs and missiles to keep the American aircraft carriers away from the Chinese coast, especially, and away means very much away, then we're going to have the real thing, which I would say it's from 2020, 2022 onwards. But in the next few years are going to be quite something, in fact, because it's, I would say this is the beginning, maybe the slow beginning of the end of the Bretton Woods international relations systems as we know it for the past 50, 60 years, essentially.
And also looking at the German angle, the North Stream line doesn't go over land. It does connect directly.
Exactly. It goes through the Baltic. Exactly.
South Stream Line, which is ought to be finished next year, and their consortium also has Dutch, French, and German, and I think Italian companies included. So
exactly.
Even more reasons not to, to mess around with sanctions. But it's I don't know if it was intentional or not, but it seems like they've created pressure to lift sanctions on Iran because the timing on it's perfect. Putin's striking a deal with the Chinese next month. And of course, they've got to seal that first before they consider cutting gas off or Ukraine not being able to pay for it. But once that's sealed and it overlaps with the end of the interim period, the 6 month period, it seems like Iran actually has a window for the right thing for the wrong reasons, but they may have a window to get some of these horrible sanctions taken off of them.
Exactly.
The Europeans are going to need it. And like you said, shale gas, they can't get it quick enough, and there's no other replacement, really. BTC lines open, but they're cashed out. They're already maximized, and so that's from Azerbaijan / BP. And it also includes Gazprom and that consortium, too. So I really don't see another option for Europe other than massive austerity.
Exactly, massive austerity, which, considering what's going on in Europe still, I just came back from Europe, you know, last week, basically. I was in Spain and France. Spain is it's an absolute disaster. It's gonna go on like this for, I would say, years. And everybody was saying the same thing. They are basically trying to survive.
There's so little coverage of the riots there in the March.
Exactly.
Breaking
exactly.
Windows, attacking police and everything.
Yeah.
No, yeah, nothing. Just what were they doing? They were following around the airplane that got lost, 370 or whatever, like ignoring what was happening in Spain.
That airplane who's in Diego Garcia? Yeah, of course. I have this Diego Garcia nagging feeling in my mind for a month now, you know. The thing is, we cannot prove it, no?
Nah, I just think it's distraction media. The fact that they paid so much attention to it said, flag saying, look away, look away.
Yeah, but how this bloody thing disappeared? If we analyze everything that we know so far, I would say the best option is, if it's not in Diego Garcia, they were trying to land it in Diego Garcia and everything went wrong. They vaporized it with a laser, you name it. But there is a Diego Garcia element involved. I could bet the best bottles of Margaux on that.
I don't know. I just don't see the motive. Like, if you have an airstrip, you already have plenty of planes. It just seems like it crashed to me in the water. That's as simple. But I didn't really look into that because I would say, if that's on TV, then I'm going to ignore it and dig into something else.
And I didn't have time to look into it. But apparently the coverage in the U.S. was wall-to-wall, né? For days. Né?
Oh, it was like the new O.J. Simpson trial. It was... We saw that, I don't know, it was a year or 2 years ago where the miners got trapped in, I think it was Chile or something.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And they talked about that for like a month.
Yeah.
And ignored everything else. I mean, but that's, you know, it's weird. They all have uniform catchphrases in the same news. All of the three-letter networks are all covering the same story, which is amazing. You think one of them could cover something else and break away, but they don't.
No, because they're always trying to out-compete each other. They're always copying each other. Yeah, it's the same ministry of truth screenplay everywhere.
We will out-sensationalize you.
By the way, did you see
Captain... It's not one network. There's more than one. So you have a choice of which one, even though it's all the same stuff, that you're going to watch. They brand them differently. You got the left-wing MSNBC, right-wing Fox, and CNN's like, look, we're in the middle. But no, there is no middle in that because there's no difference between the two.
Exactly. So we have
graphic branding.
Exactly. Six Ministry of Truth, overlapping Ministry of Truth.
It's like, look, you have a choice. See, this talking head has different color hair.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I prefer to watch a Captain America Winter Soldier. At least you laugh about it.
Hey, that was excellent. It is a comic book movie, and that's where that stuff belongs. And
this week I watched something really psychedelic, Noah.
Oh yeah, I saw the preview for that.
So Gladiator Crow in his ark. Oh man, I thought I had some LSD on my mind, really. And the end is really psychedelic. The last, okay, that's a spoiler. The last few images of the movie, they are a rainbow, a psychedelic rainbow, you know. So it was really a mega trip. Hmm.
Well, we're digressing into film here, but I do recommend Captain America. I enjoyed that.
I strongly recommend Captain America. Absolutely. Oh,
yeah. You touched on a lot of themes there. They were getting a little, you know, for Hollywood, that's about as good as it's going to get. So.
Exactly. No, it's not a dumb movie at all.
No. Not, and I mean, you just replace S.H.I.E.L.D. with CIA and you got it.
Exactly. It's all there. It's all exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all there. It's all there. Like, what does Hydra really mean? What does S.H.I.E.L.D. really mean? It's so easy to, you know exactly who they're talking about. Departmentalization and all of it. It was great. Great film. I love Marvel. I like that. But getting back to this China deal, just how huge is this? Because you're talking about a 30-year supply from Gazprom. Will they even need the Europeans so much after that?
No, because then their main client is going to be China, and the Russians are aiming at Japan and South Korea as well. There's a network of East Siberian pipelines going east. So in the long run, their destiny as a company, Gazprom and the clients and the client base is Asia. It will be much more important than Europe, in fact.
Japan's very thirsty for it, too. Obama is here tonight, actually, in Japan. I thought I smelled something, but...
Went to Jiro Sushi Bar in Tokyo, which... I was there in 19... when I saw that, I said, damn, I went to this bar in 1998, Ryan, when the guy was... he was not a celebrity chef. He was one of the good sushi chefs in Tokyo, and a friend of mine in Tokyo at the time said, "Go to this, Ginza Station. Go to the basement near. There's this little bar, and it was fantastic, but nothing as spectacular as you can have some of the best sushi in the world in Hong Kong as well, or even in São Paulo in Brazil as well. So it's not something out of this world, and." Obama apparently loved his sushi dinner with Abe, TPP Abe.
So it's not with him. Maybe that's why he enjoyed it. Ooh.
I was wondering who's actually going to pay the bill for the sushi dinner, because the thing is, Obama wants basically to impose on Abe the American terms of the TPP. And the Japanese, the captains of industry, are telling Abe, look, watch out, because if we sign this thing the way it is now, they're going to take over everything here tomorrow, which is the purpose of the TPP, basically. It's for American huge multinationals to finally open a very close Japanese market. That's the essence of the TPP.
Yeah, Japan's very mercantile, which I don't like, but... It'd be a lot worse to join TPP, because that's not the way to break out of your shell. Any kind of trade agreement that's negotiated in secret, anybody, you don't have to know anything about economics or anything. Once you know that much already, you know it's bad.
Exactly. Nobody knows the real terms. And it's just like the transatlantic free trade agreement between the US and Europe. This is what they were really discussing in Europe this past few weeks, in fact. It's nothing. People, average Europeans, like in Spain and France where I was, they're not talking about sanctions on Ukraine. They don't care. They don't even know where Ukraine is, you know. They love Ukrainian women, and that's it. They were talking all the time about the secret negotiations in Brussels about this agreement. And they are terrified, especially... artisan producers, small producers, you know, really quality, super class agriculture in the Club Med countries. They're terrified that if this thing is signed, they're going to disappear tomorrow. Monsanto, Starbucks, you know, is going to take over everything. So this is the real preoccupation for the average European. It has nothing to do with Ukraine. You know.
Yeah, well, that's the classic takeover too. They can't get bailed out. They don't have any money, but they do have assets and they do have food and things that can be produced. And they'll go buy them up when they're in desperate situations and, you know, pennies on the dollar and further their monopolies and control. And that's the whole game. And they work in tandem with IMF and other sort of large lending institutions who are involved in predatory debt, you know, intentional predatory debt to get this process going. It's a classic system that they've done over and over again. But people see through it now. And I think in large part because of the internet, that they're not falling for it anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially in Europe. In Europe, okay, for all their problems, but you still have very strong progressive outfits and publications and discussions, universities, online media. People are much more politicized than in the US or Canada, for that matter. It's a completely different ballgame. And of course, this, if they sign the deal, it will have to go to the European Parliament. And I'm sure a lot of representatives in the European Parliament will veto it completely, especially because most of the all the negotiations were secret so far. Nobody really knows what's inside this agreement. It's crazy. Apart from what I gather, five people in Brussels, the European Commissioner for Trade, and three or four other Sherpas who are conducting this negotiation on behalf of the European Commission. Nobody else knows what's in it, you know.
Yeah, the secret of trade. And, you know, we know what's in it. I mean, we don't know what's in it, but we know the general theme of what they're going to do, the same thing as they always do. And it's impossible, but if the mafia could have an IPO, I'd jump on it because you know that sanctions always create giant black markets.
Mafia IPO. I love it. I'm going to propose to my banker friends here in Hong Kong, you know. Maybe
can the mob have an initial public offering for their black markets and gas trade and so on and agriculture? But really, I just see it's like the mob is just the smaller gang from government, which is the main mafia. I mean, there's really very little difference. Just one is more organized.
Yeah, exactly. And instead of having, you know, people in trunks, Godfella style.
They have them in Gitmo.
You send them to Gitmo.
They got it. They've got salt pits in Romania and things. I mean, they're a lot worse than the mob. I mean, the mob has some honor among thieves, but nobody can touch the IMF.
God, that's one of the worst mobs I've ever seen. Have you been to that filthy building in D.C.? It's one of the most Orwellian places I've ever been.
No, I haven't been there.
Don't go there.
Well, I'm not. I mean, there's a reason I haven't been there. catch something. I wonder sometimes if the psychopath is contagious or not by the way those guys work over there. Unbelievable.
If you go there, you catch a variant of the Black Plague, you know, absolutely.
Well, I mean, like New York's own health department building had bed bugs in it. And it's only a year old. So there's your government regulations at work. It doesn't matter. You can just bribe the regulators to say what you want them to. I mean, there's so much corruption that's pervasive in the system, but I'm really glad to have you on today to talk about Pipelandistan. Normally, the two of us are talking about the Middle East and that area and Africa, but to get more into the European or Eastern Europe side of it was an interesting angle to explore. And I really recommend to all of you, Pepe's written all of this out on Asia Times. Just go read the articles. We just are kind of discussing and adding some details here and there. But, I mean, you can sit down and take your time and digest the names and the companies and all at your own speed. just by going to Age of Times, click on the best of Pepe Escobar and read all about it.
No, I you were breaking off.
Oh, well, it was recording on my end, so hopefully.
Thailand calm.
I know, man. Bangkok, the hardest was calling Thomas Mountain in Eritrea. I just you know what? We're going to use a phone. I'll just pay.
But in North Korea, you cannot even use your own cell phone. They confiscate your cell phone when you land. In fact,
wow.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's something amazing. I had two cell phones when I went there, and I gave them one of them, and I had forgotten the other one in my backpack. They found it, kept it, and when I was taking my train back to China, a government functionary shows up with my cell phone. Amazing. At the station. This is brilliant. This is a police state in action, but a competent police state. They know everything about you, and the exact right time when you are leaving the country, so you get your phone back.
Oh, maybe they went through all your calls and everything, and they said, he's not so bad. Give it to him.
We don't care.
He's better than, what was your 3-4 hour layover in Israel?
Exactly. Yeah. He's not an SA. He's okay.
They spotted you in the airport there in Tel Aviv or whatever. They get him, harass him. But Pepe, okay. always a pleasure to have you on. You have the best analysis, and we've already seen your crystal ball here in the future. And so we'll see. It's going to be exciting next month with the deal in China and what's going to happen with the sanctions in Iran, or anything going to be lifted. What's going to happen?
Exactly. Let's talk after the deal. All right.
Let's talk after the deal, because we kind of have a lot of what ifs right now. And we kind of know what's going to happen, I think. But, you know, we'll see how big the deal is. And more importantly, what kind of currencies are going to be used? How they're going to purchase this? Will it be a basket or what they're going to do? It won't be the dollar. So more than likely. So. And we'll discuss what kind of effect that could have on economies worldwide.
Okay, look, you're breaking off again. It's like you're becoming this disemboweled voice in a B movie somewhere.
I was saying we're going to discuss after we know what the deal is in China, and after we know how they're going to pay for it, what currencies they're going to use, or what kind of. Then exactly. we'll have a lot more to discuss. That's what I was saying.
Fantastic. Deal. Absolute deal, man.
Excellent.
Keep it up and kick ass as usual. You always do.
Hey, thanks, man. Thank you very much.
That was Pepe Escobar, ladies and gentlemen. You can find all his work at atimes.com. That's the Age of Times if you want to Google it. Best of Pepe Escobar. And he has several interviews on ANC Report and also Geopolitics with Ryan Dawson when I worked for Boiling Frogs and Sybil Edmonds. And that was worth a dollar, wasn't it? These interviews are usually over an hour. I'd put out several per week. And I'm asking you again to please consider giving a donation. If everybody does it, I won't have to beg you anymore. This is how it works. Consider giving a few dollars today. I'm going to have David Stein on next. That will be up Saturday, Japan time, Friday, U.S. time. We're going to dig a lot deeper than we did last time. It's really going to hit the fan. And I appreciate people like that having the courage to speak out on such topics. I get a lot of flack for it too. You do not want to miss that one. But I really don't want to make it a pay service, so please consider $5. Just $5. I'll end up with $4 and change after PayPal snags its taxes and so on. But that's all we're going to need. If you really believe in this and you really support this work, the theme of it, the justice of it, that small amount, less than one beer at a bar, or a Starbucks coffee or whatever, can have a profound impact. I hate asking for money. I really do. I don't think anybody really enjoys it. But I ask you to donate if you can. Small amounts are fine, because there are so many of you. And gather your friends. I don't care if it's $1, $2, whatever. I understand how bad the economic times are. I wrote a book about it. But collectively, you have a lot of power, and you can really help me out. I'll be able to make more films. Not just War by Deception and Decades of Deception. If you can finance these projects, Not only are we going to have the podcast, I'll be popping out documentaries left and right. I just need the time to do it. And the more we get, the higher the production value is, etc. You get it. Please hit the yellow donate button. And if you have a problem with that, try and contact me on Facebook, because I have had some people say they tried to donate and they couldn't. So I'm having the web techie work out the bugs there. But see what you can do. Please give today so that I don't have to stress at the end of the month. And enjoy David Stein on Friday. And it looks like maybe Doug Valentine after that. We'll see.